KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
That was a huge red flag. That's something that you just don't do. It violates every core concept of security and best practice.
We'll hear from a whistleblower who says DOGE has been grabbing sensitive data from all over the federal government.
For Tuesday, April 15th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg took the stand today in a landmark antitrust trial. We'll have the latest.
Later, celebrated chef Roy Choi is out with his first cookbook, and he wants to elevate the humble vegetable.
How do you make vegetables exciting, raw vegetables exciting? You go to the farmer's market and get really great vegetables, but that's not going to solve the problem.
Plus, a quarterback's departure rocks college football.
And woodpeckers are vandalizing car mirrors in a small Massachusetts town.
These birds are... they're big and they're mean and they don't like their reflection.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says he's still cutting U.S. AID programs. NPR's Michelle Kelman reports Rubio's also put an official connected to Elon Musk and his cost-cutting Doge team in a key position of the State Department.
The State Department says Jeremy Lewin is now acting head of foreign assistance. He's a Doge associate who helped to dismantle the U.S. Agency for International Development. The news comes as Rubio touts continued budget cuts at the State Department. Here's spokesperson Tammy Bruce.
The State Department has canceled another 139 grants worth $214 million under Secretary Rubio's direction.
She would not comment on leaked memos of far more drastic cuts that the Trump administration is planning to the department's budget. She says the White House is still working on its proposals. Michelle Kelleman, NPR News, the State Department.
On Capitol Hill, Meta Chief Executive Mark Zuckerberg testified for a second day in a federal antitrust trial. NPR's Bobby Allen reports the case brought by the Trump administration is threatening to break up Meta's billion-dollar business empire.
Zuckerberg faced a barrage of questions from a Federal Trade Commission lawyer. The focus was what motivated the executive to purchase Instagram and WhatsApp. Zuckerberg said when it came to Instagram, the company then known as Facebook was considering building its own camera. But Instagram already had a better service. So, quote, I thought it was better to buy them. This statement goes to the heart of the FTC's case that Meta used a buy or bury strategy to cement its status as a social media monopoly. The FTC wants Meta to spin off Instagram and WhatsApp as separate companies. But Zuckerberg says the deals were already approved a decade ago, and that Meta now faces plenty of competition from other social media apps like TikTok. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Auto prices are being pushed up by tariffs, even before a tariff on cars and car parts specifically kicks in. That will make it more expensive to buy, repair, and maintain a car. As NPR's Camila Domonoski explains, it could also mean upward pressure on auto insurance rates.
Pandemic-era supply chain snarls pushed up repair costs and sent insurance rates soaring. Now, tariffs on steel, aluminum, and many imports could do the same again. Shannon Martin, an insurance expert at Bankrate, says when insurance companies face higher costs, they have to increase what they charge to match.
If you get into a car accident, they know that the cost of that accident is going to cost them a lot more in the future than it would have in the past.
Rates won't go up overnight. There's a bit of a delay. There's also huge uncertainty around nearly every facet of these tariffs, which makes it hard to predict consumer impacts. Camila Domonoski, NPR News.
Healthcare company Johnson & Johnson says we'll see higher costs for a variety of products due to the Trump administration tariffs against China. J&J says it expects tariffs will be felt primarily in the company's medical technology unit. This is NPR. In response to NPR's reporting about the activities of the Department of Government Efficiency at the National Labor Relations Board, a top Democrat in the House is now asking independent agency watchdogs to investigate. The story based on a whistleblower's disclosure to Congress, suggesting sensitive information about union organizing and corporate trade secrets might have been removed from the independent agency's computer systems by DOGE. The House Oversight Committee's asked the Inspectors General of the Department of Labor and the NLRB to investigate what access DOGE operatives may have had. A new study shows a further decline in TV series and films being shot in Los Angeles, once the entertainment capital. NPR's Manolito Barco has more.
On location productions in Los Angeles dipped more than 22% the first 3 months of this year, according to Film LA, which issues film permits in the area. The nonprofit group found production also shrank on LA sound stages. Spokesman Philip Sokolowski says other states and countries have lucrative tax credits to lure productions out of California. Meanwhile, studios and streamers are ordering fewer series and films.
It's not just Los Angeles that is feeling this. It's happening in every other major production center. And with less work to go around, the competition for what's left is intensified.
The report says the recent wildfires had only a small effect on LA filming. Productions are still rebounding from the COVID-19 pandemic and delays by the Hollywood writers and performers strikes. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Oil prices fell today. Oil down 20 cents a barrel to $61.33 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. President Trump's Department of Government Efficiency Team, or DOGE, appears to be collecting sensitive data from all over the government. A whistleblower has come forward by filing an official disclosure to Congress. The disclosure is over concerning activity at one independent federal agency, the National Labor Relations Board. NPR's Jenna McLaughlin spoke to that whistleblower. He described to NPR what he saw and how DOGE appeared to go to great lengths to try to cover its tracks.
It was a Friday afternoon in February when Daniel Baroulas got a call from his boss. DOGE, the new federal cost-cutting unit effectively led by billionaire Trump advisor Elon Musk, would be arriving soon.
I was working on a spreadsheet for some budgeting stuff, and I got a call from my boss saying, hey, it's possible DOGE will show up.
The following week, according to his official disclosure to Congress, Baroulas and his colleagues watched a black SUV with a police escort pull into the parking garage of the National Labor Relations Board in Southeast Washington, D.C. The small independent federal agency investigates and adjudicates complaints about unfair labor practices. It stores reams of potentially sensitive data, such as private legal notes and ongoing labor investigations, or confidential lists of union organizers. Most of that data lives on the cloud, a virtual computer system that can be accessed remotely. It's Baroulas' job to watch over the cloud and make sure no single user has access to data or systems they don't need. But for DOGE, those policies and guidelines didn't seem to apply, Baroulas says. They had a very specific request.
Do not log the accounts, don't log the access, and stay out of our way.
That was just the start for Baroulas and his colleagues.
That was a huge red flag. That's something that you just don't do. It violates every core concept of security and best practice.
After his suspicions were raised, Baroulas was able to hunt down a few details about what took place while DOGE had access. In his disclosure to Congress, there's a ton of complicated technical detail. But here's what it says. There's clear evidence DOGE got the highest level of access to the system, that a big chunk of data left the agency's internal case management system, followed by another chunk of data leaving the agency itself, and that whoever had done those things had turned off security tools and network monitoring logs. They deleted records and appeared to try and disguise the chunks of data leaving the agency as routine web traffic. And after the DOGE accounts were created, someone with an IP address in Russia started trying to log into the NLRB system, using a username and password that DOGE had created. Even though the attempts were blocked, Baroulas says that made him worried. The system was more vulnerable now. The NLRB tells NPR the agency did not authorize DOGE to access their systems and that there's no record of DOGE requesting it. They also said there was a recent internal investigation that ruled out a breach. However, the disclosure includes forensic evidence and records of communications that seem to tell a different story.
Why was that done? And that's a purposeful effort. That doesn't just happen. Logs don't just disappear. Tools don't just turn themselves off randomly. Everything in a computer
has a cause and effect. So that means it has to have a trigger.
NPR has talked to 10 outside cybersecurity experts, embedded in companies, government agencies, and the private sector, who reviewed Baroulis' claims. They say the activity is suspicious, and that there's no reason a legitimate user would act this way, or remove data that is protected by multiple federal laws, including the Privacy Act. They say it is hard to definitively prove what happened without further access to the NLRB systems, or without an investigation by agencies with more resources, like the FBI. But from what they can see, none of this behavior is normal. They told NPR the shadowy tactics described in the disclosure are the kinds of things criminals and hackers from China and Russia like to do. Meanwhile, several labor law experts who spoke to NPR say they believe there is no possible reason why DOGE should have had access to or removed NLRB's sensitive labor data.
There is nothing that I can see about what DOGE is doing that follows any of the standard procedures for how you do an audit that has integrity and that's meaningful and that will actually produce results.
Sharon Block is the director of Harvard Law School Center for Labor and a Just Economy. She has held key labor policy jobs in multiple administrations, including as a member of the National Labor Relations Board. She said she thinks DOGE's statements about cutting waste and its behavior don't match up.
That mismatch between what they're doing and what we know the established professional way to do what they say they're doing, that just kind of gives away the store that they are not about actually finding more efficient ways for the government to operate.
The concerns aren't limited to just cybersecurity or exposure of union data. For Block and others, one of the most troubling things is that the NLRB has multiple ongoing investigations into Elon Musk's companies, including SpaceX and Tesla. In a recent interview with Fox News' Sean Hannity, President Trump and Musk said business interests wouldn't pose a conflict.
I mean, I haven't asked the president for anything ever. Obviously, I'm getting a sort of a daily proctology exam here. You know, it's not like I'm going to be getting away from something in the dead of night.
Neither the White House nor DOGE responded to NPR's request for comment. But so far, neither Trump nor Musk has provided evidence of any firewall between Musk and the data DOGE has access to. Musk or anyone else who gets this data could use lists of union leaders to blacklist people or fire them. They could spy on competitors. It could give them big advantages in court or in business.
It's not just that he's a random person who's getting access to information that a random person shouldn't have access to, but that if they really did get everything, if that possibility is accurate, then he has information about the case that the government is building against him.
After Baroulis dug through the agency records, he alerted his colleagues. According to his disclosure, many of them shared his concerns, and they decided they'd launch a breach investigation and call in experts from other agencies to help. The NLRB says those concerns were investigated, and it was determined there was no breach. But Baroulis' disclosure makes clear that it's the possibility of an insider threat that warrants a closer look. It's the removal of evidence of potentially suspicious activity that concerns him. That's part of the reason he decided to speak up.
At the end of the day, even if it's logically not the right choice, if it morally compels me, I feel I wouldn't be able to live with myself otherwise. To know that this data was out there, it's going to impact these cases. It's going to cost people their real livelihoods.
There are now over a dozen court cases revealing how DOGE has mishandled sensitive data, from Social Security databases to Treasury payment systems. A source working on Capitol Hill who requested anonymity to discuss ongoing sensitive investigations says their staff has multiple other whistleblower reports about DOGE exfiltrating sensitive data for unknown reasons.
I believe with all my heart that this goes far beyond just case data.
In other words, it could be Social Security numbers, private addresses, healthcare data, immigration status, you name it. Baroulis hopes to inspire others to speak up. Jenna McLaughlin, NPR News.
And now to Rockport, Massachusetts, where woodpeckers are wrecking car windows and mirrors. Dealing with the chaos is exhausting residents, and you can just hear it in their voices.
So there's a group of these giant woodpeckers, and at first, no big deal. They just cruised around. They're loud. They're big. They sound like monkeys. Like, ah! Can't even do it right. But they've started smashing mirrors on cars. Because they see their own reflection and it's mating season, so they're going nuts.
That is Devin Mock, 36 years old, raised in the coastal town of Rockport.
I cook at my family's restaurant right on the water. It's a great place to grow up. I love it here.
But this year, he, his friends, and neighbors do not love the pileated woodpecker, and it seems for good reason.
They're big and they're mean, and they don't like their reflection.
One bird expert believes that one single woodpecker is responsible for attacking people's mirrors and car windows on one street alone. The why all comes down to science.
So this is a male woodpecker, and with this time of year, they have elevated levels of testosterone, a hormone that if a male comes into their territory, they want to defend it. And with birds, they don't perceive glass or mirrors well. And when they see the reflection in a mirror, they don't see it as themselves. They see it as another woodpecker.
That is John Herbert. He is director of bird conservation with Mass Audubon in Massachusetts.
We're in mid-April now, so this is the time of the year when our birds are starting to enter what's known as the breeding season. So they're starting to, when they nest, lay eggs and start raising their young. But to prepare for that, the birds establish what's known as territories.
And to establish territories, the males work to keep other male birds away, even if that other bird is their own reflection.
I know a guy, he's a fisherman that lives down the street. I think they like the mirrors that are longer, like on trucks or on vans and stuff. It's because they can land on the side of them, and then they see themselves, and they blast the mirror. But he lost two mirrors. Another guy that lives up the street, he has a conversion van, and he's convinced they've broken the back window. They're terrible. They're monsters.
Rockport resident Devin Mock says some of his daily conversations with one of his neighbors sound a lot like this.
Let's just say, I probably can't say it on the radio, but he's not happy. Have you seen any of those something birds around, he doesn't like them.
To slow down the destruction, Mass Audubon's John Herbert has this advice.
Covering up your mirrors, if you happen to have a large woodpecker attacking your mirrors, covering it up with any material should mitigate that potential source of it breaking.
But both agree this is all just part of nature, right?
Birds are wonderful creatures, and this is a fascinating behavior. You know, it's unfortunate that mirrors and some property is being damaged, but we can do our best to mitigate that loss for ourselves and also live with these birds and with our wildlife and nature.
I'm sure my neighbors would say a different story, but they're just birds. They're doing their thing. You know, it's nature. What are you gonna do?
It's All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The White House is proposing that virtually all federal funding for public media, so NPR and PBS, that it be eliminated. The Trump administration has drafted a memo to Congress outlining its intent to cut that money, a move that the broadcasters say would be devastating to American communities nationwide. Here at NPR, we report on ourselves, just as we would any other organization. And my colleague, NPR Scott Newman, has been working this story today. Hi, Scott.
Hi there.
So we have, of course, been tracking pieces of the story for weeks now. We covered the FCC launching an investigation into NPR and PBS underwriting practices. We covered last month's testimony by the leaders of NPR and PBS before a House subcommittee. Walk me through this latest development. This is the White House asking Congress to eliminate funding. Explain.
Yeah, this is something called rescission. In a memo that is being drafted by the White House, we're told, that will be sent to Congress once lawmakers return from recess on April 28th. What will happen is that will start a window of 45 days in which the House and Senate have the opportunity to either approve the administration's call to end funding or to allow the money to be restored.
And just to explain rescission, this would include money that has already been approved, already been allocated. How much money are we talking?
Yeah, Congress has already appropriated $1.1 billion over the next 2 years for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And a reminder, that's the nonprofit congressionally chartered body that partly funds NPR and PBS and other public media. So essentially, the federal funds for public broadcasting would be cut immediately and then the next 2 years, so through 2027, the end of the fiscal year.
In a few sentences, what would the impact of that be on public broadcasting in the United States?
Well, NPR receives about 1% of its funding directly from the federal government, but hundreds of NPR member stations across the country get a larger percentage, and they would be hit harder. And since those stations use some of the federal money they get from CPB to pay a fee to NPR to carry programs such as All Things Considered, the indirect impact on NPR could be greater. Since television is more expensive than radio, PBS gets a larger chunk of the pie from CPB, about 15% of its funding.
Why does the White House say it wants to do this?
Well, for some Republicans, canceling federal funding for CPB has been on the agenda for years. But in the past few years, conservatives have stepped up attacks on NPR and PBS, accusing the networks of left-wing political bias and woke programming. The networks say they produce high-quality, balanced, and informative programs. In the past, though, many conservatives have been more supportive of public media. But with today's charged political environment, more of them seem to be standing behind Trump and people like Georgia Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has been a loud proponent of defunding public media.
I know that you've been reaching out and getting reaction on this. What are you hearing back from the leaders of NPR and PBS?
Well, a reminder that NPR CEO Catherine Marr and PBS CEO and President Paula Kerger both appeared in March before a congressional subcommittee that was chaired by Marjorie Taylor Greene to defend public broadcasting. Today, NPR issued a statement saying that eliminating funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting would be a great disservice to the American public. In a statement, the network said, "We serve the public interest. It's not just in our name. It's our mission. Across the country, locally owned public media stations represent a proud American tradition of public-private partnership for our shared common good."
Thanks for your reporting, Scott.
Thank you.
That's NPR's Scott Newman. And I will note we have invited NPR CEO Catherine Marr to take our questions on this, and we hope to bring you that interview tomorrow.
Every week, a guest draws a card from NPR's wildcard deck and answers a big question about their life. Julianne Nicholson is an expert at portraying grief. She does it as the best friend in Mayor of Easttown and as the lead in Janet Planet. But she was relieved to get to do something different with her character Sinatra in the Hulu show Paradise.
It is so fun to have that because I have to work hard now for what I do, that it's not always like grief, because also it's like that doesn't come for free to continue to do that. And I'm happy that Sinatra, as evil as she is, like she's also pretty funny.
Nicholson spoke with Wildcard host Rachel Martin about other trade-offs that she's had to confront in her personal life.
What's something you've had to give up as you've grown up?
Well, alcohol.
I just did that 6 months ago.
Yeah. In 2016,
oh, wow.
I realized like it was not working for me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been a huge gift. Not always easy, but
no.
Yeah, really good.
I mean, I have like a million questions about this.
Yeah.
Because this is kind of still a relatively new thing for me.
Yeah.
I also realized it was not doing me any favors. And had been a real crutch for me for a long time.
Sames.
But I still find it difficult to socialize.
I completely understand. And I feel like at first it was terrifying to feel like I can't believe I have to go in there sober. And now it feels like actually I'm not great at social situations. That's okay. Like,
yeah,
when there's a lot of people, I can, like, barely even pay attention to what anyone is saying, especially if I don't know them. I'm fine in, like, if it's a group of friends, like, that's easy. But if I'm in, like, at a work event or a school event for my kids and there's too many people and I don't know them well enough and people are talking to me, like, it's not my strong suit. And
so do you leave? Do you not go to those things?
I mean, I have to for my job, actually, but I usually try to latch on to someone who I know, who's like my like little security, social security blanket.
Yep.
And I just give myself a break. Like, I don't have to be good at it.
Yeah. And what do you drink?
Sparkling water.
Yeah. Not even drinking like a ginger beer or like.
Sometimes I like ginger beer with a meal. I like non-alcoholic beer.
Yeah,
like, there are good ones now. So I only ever want like one of them.
I still struggle when people when there's so much excitement about let's meet for a glass of wine and their enthusiasm for the event centered around the alcohol is so acute.
Yeah,
and I feel like the buzzkill being like. I'll have your non-alcoholic beer.
Probably the longer you have with that, I imagine you'll feel less worried about that.
Self-conscious.
The other person can still do that. And then often when they're in like, you know, two drinks, three drinks in, I'm like, thank God I am clear. And I'm going to feel good tomorrow when I wake up.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's worth it. But that was definitely... I didn't want to have to give that up.
You can see Julianne Nicholson in Paradise on Hulu. And you can watch that full conversation on YouTube or Spotify. Just search for Wildcard with Rachel Martin.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com.
This is NPR News.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep. When you roll out of bed, bleary-eyed and groggy, if you're like me, the first thing on your mind is getting something to wake you up. So turn on the radio. NPR's daily news program, Morning Edition, has been working through the night to get you the news you need. It's as essential to your morning as a good cup of coffee. So hit the ground running by listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The man who put Korean-Mexican fusion on the map is out with a new cookbook. And Chef Roy Choi says eating healthy doesn't mean eating boring.
I want you to cook that dish in that chapter and forget that you're not cooking meat. Yeah. I want you to even think that you're cooking meat.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump says he will protect American farmers caught in the middle of his trade war with China, but he didn't provide any specific details on what form that protection would take. Trump's comments come just days after slapping a 145% tariff on Chinese goods coming into the U.S. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt says it's up to Beijing to make the next move because China wants what we have.
I do have an additional statement that he just shared with me in the Oval Office. The ball is in China's court. China needs to make a deal with us. We don't have to make a deal with them. There's no difference between China and any other country, except they are much larger. And China wants what we have, what every country wants, what we have, the American consumer. Or to put it another way, they need our money.
But American soybean farmers could suffer under these tariffs, and many of them are in states that voted for President Trump. A federal judge says Ryan Ruth's lawyers will be able to test fire that semi-automatic rifle he allegedly was planning to use to assassinate Donald Trump. NPR's Greg Allen says a Secret Service agent fired on Ruth while Trump was golfing at his club in Florida last year.
At a hearing in Fort Pierce, Florida, Ruth's lawyers asked U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon to allow a defense expert to examine and test fire the weapon. Because the rifle had a scope attached in a makeshift manner, they questioned whether it would have been accurate enough for a sniper attack on the then presidential candidate. Prosecutors say the question of how well the gun worked is not relevant to the case. Ruth is charged with attempting to assassinate a presidential candidate, and his intent to do so is all that matters. Judge Cannon said she will allow a defense expert to test fire the rifle to check its operability, but not its accuracy as a weapon when used at a distance by a sniper. Greg Allen, NPR News, Fort Pierce, Florida.
You're listening to NPR News. Global air travel has recovered from the pandemic as Atlanta's International Airport celebrates its 100th anniversary, defending its title as the busiest airport in the world. From member station WABE, Marlon Hyde reports.
Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International saw more than 108 million passengers in 2024, according to industry group Airports Council International World. It's followed by Dubai International Airport and Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport in the world's busiest ranking. Preliminary data shows that globally, about 9.5 billion people flew last year, surpassing pre-pandemic numbers by almost 4%. The group says challenges like economic uncertainty and potential global trade disruptions will continue to impact the industry. In 2025, global passenger traffic is expected to increase to almost 10 billion. For NPR News, I'm Marlon Hyde in Atlanta.
One of the nation's leading healthcare companies expects to shell out $400 million in tariff-related costs. Johnson & Johnson says the costs will be felt primarily in the production of medical devices and surgical products. The company CEO says the best way to increase manufacturing here in the U.S. is through tax policy, not the steep tariffs the Trump administration is exacting on U.S. trading partners. Stocks finished lower across the board today. The Dow down 155 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation,
an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg was grilled today in federal court again. It was the second day of Zuckerberg testifying in an antitrust case brought by the Federal Trade Commission. We want to note Meta is an NPR sponsor, but we report on the company same as any other company we cover. NPR's Bobby Allen has been in the courtroom in Washington. He is in the studio now with me to discuss how the future of the social media giant may be on the line. Hey, Bobby.
Hey, Mary Louise.
So, day two, Zuckerberg on the stand. Any big takeaways?
Yeah, today was much more combative. A Federal Trade Commission lawyer really hammered Zuckerberg with questions trying to illustrate why exactly Meta, then called Facebook, purchased Instagram and WhatsApp back in 2012 and 2014. So Zuckerberg had to reflect on these decade-old emails where he and colleagues discussed the need to neutralize Instagram as a competitive threat. When asked if Zuckerberg wishes Meta had developed its own photo app instead, Zuckerberg said in a deadpan manner, quote, "I guess so. $1 billion is very expensive." That elicited some chuckling in the courtroom. But the FTC's mission today was to get Zuckerberg to concede that Meta used its wealth and power to purchase Instagram and WhatsApp because they pose an existential threat to Meta. Zuckerberg wouldn't exactly go that far, but he did admit a few times, yeah, the two apps were pretty good products. That's why I bought them.
Yeah, that takes us back to the central question at stake here. What are the FTC's allegations against Meta?
Yeah, the FTC argues that over the years, Meta has purchased rivals instead of competing fairly with them. And if it didn't buy competitors outright, it copied their services and put many apps out of business. The FTC calls this Meta's buy or bury strategy. The FTC says this is illegal and that Meta is operating a social media monopoly. And the FTC wants a judge to order Meta to fully divest from Instagram and WhatsApp by selling them off as separate businesses.
To fully divest by selling them off. What would that mean for Meta?
Yeah, it would be devastating. I mean, just consider this fact, Mary Louise. In 2015, Instagram represented 7% of Meta's advertising revenue. Today, it's more than half of Meta's total revenue. So goes without saying that being forced to sell off Instagram would hugely undercut a core part of Meta's business. But the FTC is pushing for it, saying that if Meta breaks up, it will allow smaller competitors to go toe-to-toe with Instagram. And the FTC says when there's more competition, there's better quality apps for all of us.
To which Meta says what, Bobby?
Meta says, look, this case is really about a very successful Silicon Valley company being punished, right? Meta's lawyer says the acquisition of Instagram and WhatsApp were blessed by regulators more than 10 years ago. That is true. And Meta says those decisions should not be reopened today. Meta says another huge weakness in the case is how the FTC is framing this trial. The FTC says Meta is a monopoly in the category of personal social network. So they're defining that as, apps where people communicate with their friends and family, like Snapchat, and the long extinct apps like Google Plus and MySpace.
Oh, yeah, MySpace.
Yeah, long ago, mm-hmm. Yeah. But Meta says this category is arbitrarily defined and notably does not include Meta, notably does not include TikTok, right? Which is Meta's biggest competitor. They also say they face many competitors outside of this definition, like YouTube. But remember, the FTC launched this investigation almost 6 years ago. So they're judging Meta on the social media world that existed back then. But it'll ultimately be up to a federal judge to decide whether Meta got so big because it's a savvy tech company or because it allegedly acted like a monopoly many years ago.
And NPR's Bobby Allen, thank you.
Thank you.
In 2022, then high school sensation Nico Iamaleava made headlines when he signed a multi-million dollar deal to play quarterback for the University of Tennessee. But last week, the school announced that he is leaving the university over a contract dispute. You heard that right. A contract dispute involving a college athlete. The announcement has sent shockwaves through the college football world. It leaves even more questions about how college athletes are paid. Richard Johnson covers college football for CBS Sports. He's been following all of this and joins us now. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, so just give us the main details here. Like, what exactly was at issue between the university and Ia Maliava?
Yeah, the quickest way to say it is that Ia Maliava went back to Tennessee, I think, multiple times asking for a raise. And pretty much what's at issue here is that Ia Maliava's camp wanted a number that's a little bit closer to $4 million. And I think Tennessee was quite comfortable with a number that's closer to what he's making now, which is a little bit closer to $2 million. So there was a gulf. And there were also repeated approaches, as I understand it, from Ia Maliava's camp to get a raise on his deal. And basically, things came to a head a few days before the spring game after a couple months of apparently this back and forth.
And why is this decision of Ia Maliava to walk this late in the game, so to speak, why is this causing so much upheaval in the college football world right now?
Yeah, well, it's a pretty big deal. I mean, Tennessee's a good team. They went to the college football playoff last year. They lost in the first round, but they did make it. Ia Maliava's first year as a starter was 2024. One thing of note is he wasn't actually that good for them. He was a very highly touted recruit and a highly touted prospect, but his first year as a starter, he didn't really light the world on fire. They kind of made it to the college football playoff in spite of him.
Okay, so maybe not the best player, but there was so much drama around this contract negotiation. Do you expect more failed negotiations like this to happen in college sports? I mean, how do you think schools will navigate this in the future?
Yeah, the issue inherent here is that it's a contract. There's something on paper, certainly, that tied him to Tennessee's third-party collective. But the issue is there aren't even base-level parameters like when you can negotiate. Like with an NFL contract, the NFL has had a collective bargaining agreement since 1968. There is a firm window when you can negotiate, for instance, with a free agent, or when you become a free agent, for instance. College football, college sports does not have that. So effectively what you have is, sure, I've got a piece of paper that is binding me to you, but it's a perpetual negotiation for a lot of these high-level athletes. A lot of these high-level athletes, their handlers, their parents, in Ia Maliava's case, his dad, is going behind Tennessee's back and kind of shopping him around a little bit to try to see what the best price is. Now, maybe it's because he really wanted to leave, or maybe it was just a leverage play.
Well, then what is next for Ia Maliava? Like, will he just go to another college team at this point? Or can he? How much leverage does he have?
Well, he's in the transfer portal, so he will find a home. He's talented enough to find a home. Now, I'm not sure that the home he finds will be a top 10 or a top 15 school, top 15 college football program. And I'm not sure that the home he finds will even be at the price that Tennessee was paying him per year. But he'll land somewhere just because he does have talent. He's got skills.
Well, we will have to watch the saga unfold. Richard Johnson covers college football for CBS Sports. Thank you so much, Richard.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. In 2022, an inmate with severe mental disabilities died in a rural Virginia prison. His sister sued, accusing four prison guards of fatally beating her brother and a fifth of failing to intervene. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz was in Southwest Virginia to hear the verdict in the civil trial that represented the end of a case she first started covering 2 years ago.
For 3 years, Kimberly Hobbs wondered what happened to her brother, Charles Chuck Givens, on the morning of February 5th, 2022, at Marion Correctional Treatment Center.
There's just so many unanswered questions, and I'll never get those answers.
I'm sorry that her brother passed away, you know, but we had nothing to do with it.
William Zachary Montgomery is one of five guards Hobbs sued in 2023. Hobbs said Montgomery, Anthony Raymond Kelly, Gregory Scott Plummer and Joshua Jackson beat Givens in the shower room of Marion. She claimed a fifth guard, Samuel Dale Osborne, failed to intervene to save Givens. Earlier this month, the two sides faced off at a small federal courthouse. The defense argued that Givens had a seizure in his cell, fell, and suffered his fatal injuries when he hit his metal bed frame. Montgomery was eager to get the case heard.
It just, you know, kills me. Like, I was like, our names are getting dragged through the mud for something that we did not do.
The guards resigned or retired from the Virginia Corrections Department. And back in 2022, a grand jury declined to bring a criminal indictment against them.
She couldn't prosecute them criminally. This was it.
That was Paul Stanley, one of Hobbs' attorneys. The civil case against the guards relied heavily on the testimony of fellow inmate Ron West, who said he saw guards beating Givens. But the jury was not convinced. Last Thursday, they found that the guards were not liable for Givens' death. Montgomery and the rest of the defense and their families cried for relief.
Glad that it's over. Glad that this three-year nightmare is over.
Hobbs quietly left the courthouse and started her journey home as soon as the verdict was read.
I was devastated. I'm still trying to process. I can't believe it.
Madeline Wasilchek, an assistant law professor at University of South Carolina, said this case represents something bigger.
I think his case serves as one of those tip of the iceberg cases that we so often see in jails and prisons.
Hobbs and her attorneys say Givens died after suffering years of abuse at Marion. Records show he was hospitalized multiple times for hypothermia. We first wrote about this case in 2023 and raised questions about conditions at Marion. Here's Wasilchek again.
But it seems clear that there's a systemic issue going on that wasn't unique just to Mr. Givens, but also to many others.
Hobbs said Givens' death has led to important changes to Marion.
I have to believe that, you know, he didn't, I guess, die in vain, because now they've added cameras to the showers.
Stanley and Hobbs say the case and the scrutiny it brought means better conditions for inmates. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The chef Roy Choi is a legend here in Los Angeles. So when I heard that he wanted to cook something with me, I was like, heck yeah.
And you go in and the kitchen feels like a food truck.
Oh, it's tight.
It's really tight. Butts be button in here.
Oh yeah, butts be button.
Butts be button.
Yeah. Choi made a name for himself with his roving Kogi barbecue food trucks, which offer Korean short rib tacos, kimchi quesadillas. I mean, he put Korean Mexican fusion on the map here. And now he is out with his first ever full-on cookbook, The Choi of Cooking. And today, in his teeny tiny kitchen at the Alibi Room in West LA, he is going to show me his ways.
You can't take your eye off this. You have to be fully engaged. Because the difference between delicious and burnt is minuscule.
We're frying up eggs, hash browns, tofu, and kimchi on the flat top griddle here for Choi's take on the breakfast burrito. We throw down our massive tortillas, which he's going to show me how to roll right up.
Should I do max filling?
No.
Oh.
Not for your first time.
Okay.
That's advanced level.
All right.
Now
we pile on the hot stuff, top it with cheese, cilantro, onions, and a ginger sesame slaw.
And then now roll it. So
sides first.
Sides first.
Uh-huh. Then this side.
Over, and then
pinky.
You're gonna go over pinky. And over. Boom.
Really?
Amazing.
I did it.
Amazing.
Boom! Okay, but now the moment of truth. Could I, Elsa Chang, replicate the burrito mastery of the Kogi King himself? Well, there's only one way to find out. You know what they love on NPR? You know what sound they love the most?
ASMR?
Mouth sounds.
Okay, let's do this. Oh. No.
Mmm. This is good.
As you eat that, like, you don't think about the fact that it doesn't have meat.
No.
Right? You're just in there.
There's
so much
flavor.
So much flavor. It's like, it's rude. It's in your face. It's It's punk rock, but it's good for you.
I mean, this is a guy who rose to fame selling beef. The name of his food truck literally means meat in Korean. But now, Choi is on a quest to elevate the humble vegetable. It is the biggest chapter in his new cookbook. And this move towards a healthier, veggie-obsessed Roy Choi was a necessity for him, he says. A way to break what he calls an addiction to junk food and huge portions.
So a gallon of ice cream, I couldn't, you know, a pint was just like a hors d'oeuvre, like a devil... A pint was like a deviled egg, you know, and so it had to be a half gallon or a gallon, you know, a corner slice of lasagna was like eating a crudité. So it had to be the whole tray.
Yeah.
If I ate less, people would ask me what's wrong.
Are you okay? Eventually, Choi met a customer at one of his taco trucks who got him to think differently about how he ate. And that nudged him down a new path towards cooking veggie forward meals that are actually good for you. And that does not mean boring. The Choi of cooking, he says, is about making healthy eating exciting and approachable.
Because if you look at a lot of health food items and wellness, the wellness industry, things are packaged in a way that are very unfamiliar to someone that hasn't grown up around it or hasn't made a conscious choice to get there.
Did you set out wanting to make the vegetable chapter the biggest chapter?
I don't think in terms of structure we thought that way, but in terms of philosophy, yes.
Because you say, like, we don't treat vegetables with the respect they deserve.
You know, vegetables should curse. Like, they should be brash and curse, and they should, like, have their tongue out, you know, like a cheeseburger.
Yeah.
Like, you know? Like, it should look like the point of view of the double-double, you know? Like, that's how
a badass vegetable.
Badass, you know, badass food porn. In your face, like it should be Spinal Tap 11, you know, and that's really what it should be. And that's why the vegetables were the biggest chapter, because that's the essence and philosophy of this book is, like, I want you to cook that dish in that chapter and forget that you're not cooking meat.
Yeah.
I want you to even think that you're cooking meat.
Right.
Because the recipes are designed as if there was meat in there, you know, and that's kind of the goal of it.
It's so true. We have so unfairly branded vegetables. Like, I think about the word broccoli. That's like synonymous for, like, give me the practical information I need. Yeah. Like, just what's the broccoli in what you're actually saying? You know, like, you're
it,
vegetables.
But if you do it in slang, yeah. broccoli means cheese, it means cheddar, it means money. Yeah. You know, it means yeah. weed. You know,
yeah,
right. It means
yeah.
marijuana.
That's so funny.
So if you take the slang of the essence of the feeling of it, and put a recipe and a perspective behind it, then maybe people can start eating vegetables.
Yeah.
Because they're smoking weed, and weed is a plant.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
People love plants.
People love plants.
All right. So show me, like, in this book, how you rebrand a couple of your favorite vegetables. Give me the Roy Choi rebrand.
Okay. Yeah, it definitely needs a rebrand. And so if you look at the Veg Head chapter, we'll just start from the top. You got watermelon kimchi, right? That's something that everybody loves a fruit cart.
Yeah.
Everybody loves a fruit cart when they see a fruit cart.
Absolutely.
But they don't always love fruits when they're put on a plate, right? But then if you put watermelon into a kimchi form, then all of a sudden their minds are blown.
They're like,
I got to try it.
Yeah,
you gotta
it's weird. Some, it's unexpected. Let's
unexpected.
Do it.
You got to create some curiosity, you know. Crudités. This is the biggest one. Oh. Crudités is the hugest one in this book. Crudités have the worst branding.
I agree.
In the world.
That's the plate I skip when I'm at a buffet or I'm at a friend's house. I'm like, no, I'm going to go to the crackers
yes.
and the cheese.
Yes.
Not the cut up vegetables.
Because what's crudité in most cases? It's usually the machine cut carrots
yeah.
that are kind of rounded
yeah,
on
so
all
they're
ends.
Dried out.
They're dried out. Celery and dried snow peas. And maybe
radishes.
Yeah. And then served with like Hidden Valley Ranch dressing. And then and then they're also associated with PTA meetings and mom and school meetings. Right. Because
right.
yeah. what is always brought to meetings is brownies, cookies, and crudité platters. So how do you make vegetables exciting, raw vegetables exciting? You go to the farmer's market and get really great vegetables, but that's not going to solve the problem. A crudité platter is not the crudités. It's the dips. It's the dips.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about the dips. And
yeah,
that's the problem with the marketing behind crudités is that you're only serving it with ranch dressing or really bland hummus. You have to diversify your dips. And so
it's a dip platter. And the vegetables, just
exactly.
the spoons for the dips.
Exactly. And you have to make them spicy. You have to make them garlicky. You have to make them funky. You have to all of that stuff. So in this book, we have all of that.
Diversify your dips, people. The book is called The Choy of Cooking. It's out now, and it is the first full cookbook from the co-owner, co-founder, and chef of Kogi Barbecue, Roy Choi.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Workday, Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers.